Hello and welcome to Ordinary, a podcast that aims to help Christians live for Christ in everyday life. My name is Josh Bannister, and each week I'm joined by Graham Nichols and Mark Bentham, both pastors of Christ Church, Haywards Heath. I keep thinking that we won't talk about COVID again. There's been enough commentary on it, we've had enough opinions thrown at us left and right, and then we go ahead and talk about it again. But this week is a little bit different. As we ease lockdown measures here in the UK and more statistical data is accessible to us, there is a growing number who are suggesting that the strategy in the UK has and will do more damage than it has done good. So this week we ask, was it worth it? And in talking about areas in which we disagree with government policy, how are we to act as Christians?
Hello, my name is Graham Nichols.
And I'm Mark Bentham.
And I'm Josh Bannister, and you're listening to Ordinary. Welcome back to the podcast. We are very excited to be here on a very warm, for us, it's a Tuesday morning. What day is it today?
Tuesday,
this
Josh.
Is what happens during lockdown. I actually had no idea. It's Tuesday morning.
It's Tuesday.
Very balmy. Yeah. How are you both doing?
You've been enjoying the warm weather. I thought we were going to pretend it was Wednesday morning.
Yeah, I don't know if people buy that, you know. We can pretend, but I think they're...
I think they all know that we're not really recording live, that it's going straight into their podcast ears through us there, live stream.
Okay.
Unlike Sundays, when we are live.
It is beautifully warm, and I think it'll be beautifully warm when people listen to it tomorrow, I believe. That'll be cool. And it's been a nice weekend, a very newsworthy weekend, where the news has been dominated, if you're into the kind of political news, has been dominated by Dominic Cummings, who, for reasons he explained in painstaking detail, went to Durham to stay in an empty cottage and then returned from Durham got lots and lots of hassle for doing that as to whether he was precisely breaking the rules, breaking the spirit of the rules, setting a bad example, all those kind of things. I think people have divided quite extremely into those who kind of support him and those who probably despised him already, but particularly are kind of criticising him as a terrible role model.
It does. Mm-hmm. It does seem there's a shift going on in the political world at the moment, where actually politics is now coming back in play. So that sense of unity and all together is slightly going, and now it's kind of much more gloves off, back to political. Mug being slung, you're not doing this well, you're not doing that great, you know, kind of feeling as well.
Do you think that's probably to do with the sort of easing of people's fear as the realisation dawns that this isn't perhaps as deadly or as serious as we worried it could be? And so as the fear eases, more divide creeps in, maybe?
Possibly.
I think people still are fearful. I think talking to folks, there are a number who are still fearful. But I think, like in all things, you kind of learn to get on with it. So I think there is an unease for some and not for others. But I think, like all things, you just kind of get on with it, don't you? Life continues. That it's kind of the Ecclesiastes model. You know, life just keeps going at the end of the day. You can't stop life. So therefore, people just get on and adjust and do so accordingly. We've all learned how to dance 2 meters away from each other, you know.
I could do that already, though.
I find that we were out walking yesterday down at, you know, Seven Sisters, and everyone's keeping their distance. But then you kind of, every now and then you forget. So you're suddenly at a gate and you're suddenly with someone, and you're saying, oh, sorry, and you all back up, and then someone takes it in turns. It's all a bit, you know, like that at the moment, isn't it? Kind of. You kind of forget because life just keeps going and the sun's shining and happy days.
Yeah.
And then suddenly you remember, I'm supposed to be 2 metres, sorry, apologies, walk on through.
Someone bought me a curry.
Go on, Graham. Sorry, go ahead. I
was only going to say,
someone
bought me a curry yesterday, you know, takeaway curry, and he literally at my front door, giving me the bags like life was totally normal. And I wanted to kind of, I just got a social dilemma, like, do I tell them off and say, no, you should have put it on the floor and stood back? Or do I just say, all right, mate, thanks, and take it and then give them the cash? Which I did the latter. I said, thanks, mate, gave him the cash, went and washed my hands. That was the best I could do. Because he looked rather healthy anyway. But I think the Dominic Cummings thing, though, points up a number of things. You know, whether you agree with him or not, and that's probably something we don't want to get into because that will just polarise everyone who listens. I think it points up both the fact of should you obey the law and should you exercise judgment, but also, you know, was the lockdown a good idea in the first place? You know, what effect did it have? So I think it kind of speaks to all the issues. So it's kind of a newsworthy story that kind of gets us thinking, what would we have done? Would we have broken the law because we don't think the law's very good? Would we have broken the law because we think would we have bent the law because we think our family is important? You know, all those kind of questions. So, yeah. And I think, you know, lots of people have different views. I think, Josh, you have quite strong views about both the law itself and the value of it and the keeping of it, perhaps. I don't know.
Yeah, I had this feeling over the last few weeks when we've kind of been talking about this, and we've spoken on the podcast, you know, in some depth about COVID and about the effects and the lockdown and things. And I've never sort of given my thoughts or been totally honest, I feel, about how I think about the lockdown or about our response in the UK to it, just because I've been aware that that's a taboo thing to do. And I've felt that I should keep quiet about that. But I now am at the point where I think that there are enough people who are beginning to push back on our strategy here in the UK, where I feel a little bit more confident to sort of say how I feel about it. And then we can talk about how that links to action in terms of how, as a Christian, you live in with the tension of not agreeing potentially with government decision. There is a couple of caveats that I think are worth stating before I say anything and before any of us say anything, which is that, of course, all of us agree that every life is valuable, and that any kind of death is a sad thing and a thing that we want to avoid if possible. And so I don't want to in any comment sort of minimize the sadness or the loss that people might have experienced or know people that might have experienced, or even the illness. You know, I don't want to minimize how, you know, the illness is bad as well. That is definitely the case. I think what I want to do, though, is to step back, try to look at the data and try to look at the risks that are involved, and the decisions that have been made, and say, was it worth it? Did we go too far, and do some kind of a cost-benefit analysis on this, just to get to grips with, you know, where we actually are? Let's think about it as objectively as we can. That's kind of where I'm coming from. Is that okay?
Go for it.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. Yeah, yeah, say a few things about that, just to kind of unpack that a little bit. And I think it's completely legitimate, you don't need my permission, but I think it's completely legitimate to think, is this a good policy? Because we could think of that about lots of things, whether it's a speed limit or an abortion law. You know, there's a whole range of things in which we may disagree with the government on, with our limited knowledge. That's both our right and our responsibility, in a way, to think about that and then to think what we do with it. So yeah, what are some of your objections?
Yeah, so I think I sort of fall in line with somewhat of what, I don't know if anyone's listened to Peter Hitchens and his thoughts on this, an author, journalist. Also, Elon Musk has come out quite strongly in a position of we've really overstepped here. And I guess the main point would be that that essentially fear has been a big problem, and that the government, let's talk about the UK because that's where we are. The government has worked really hard on selling how dangerous COVID was. That was their whole mission, really, with their kind of rule of three marketing and their very strong sell of this is deadly. And I think the truth is, as the data comes out and becomes more and more accessible, we are seeing that it is not as dangerous as potentially we thought it was, and that essentially the shutting down of the economy, the locking down of people socially, does a number of things that actually are more negative than positive. So it does things like completely destroy the economy in the UK, which is going to have huge ramifications for millions, not thousands. We've seen people socially have problems, mentally have problems, and ultimately what I put in our WhatsApp group with you two guys, which is, I think, a kind of quote that I think helps understand this a little bit for me, is in World War II, Winston Churchill had that famous Battle of Britain kind of phrase where he said, never have so few sacrificed so much for so many. And I think the opposite is true during this pandemic, that never have so many sacrificed so much for so few. Now, I know that can sound really callous, and I don't want it to sound callous. It's just a statistical fact that the number of people affected is statistically very small. And as we get more and more data about the kind of people, the kind of age ranges that are being affected by this, we see more and more that actually in America, for example, the average age of people who are dying from COVID is the same as the average age that people are dying, right? I'll say that again. The average age that people are dying of COVID is the same as the average age that people are dying. And I think the point is people die. That's what happens. Like, people die of COVID, or they die of influenza, or they die of cancer. There's 78,000 deaths per year in the UK from smoking, right? That's avoidable, but we don't do anything about it. There are 26,000 deaths or severe injuries from road traffic accidents in the UK every year, but we don't do anything about that. I mean, we could say, okay, let's stop driving because it's a risk, but we don't. We accept the risk because we understand that there's going to be collateral damage, but we think it's worth it. Now, with COVID, we took a very different line where we said, actually, no, this is dangerous, and these 30,000 odd deaths or more are worth shutting down the entire economy and causing huge global damage. I just think that's interesting. And I think it's enough to talk about and say, was that a wise decision, or have we overstepped the mark? And is the government now essentially in too deep? And so they're just having to back out slowly whilst maintaining their narrative so that they don't fall under too much criticism. So I guess that's where I'm kind of at with the whole thing. So comment on that, and then we can talk about how we actually act, I suppose.
Presumably your argument is therefore, it seems to be that there's only been 36,000 deaths. Because it's only 36,000 deaths, it's an extreme measure for the sake of 36. I guess the big question in that is the what if. You know, if we hadn't have done the lockdown, would we have had, which they were, you know, 100,000 deaths, 200,000 deaths? And then you go, well, hold on a second. You know, would you then be going, actually, the government should have done more because there's 200,000 deaths more than what is average?
Yeah, and then this is where kind of the Peter Hitchens idea of actually those statistics were guesswork, and you start to look at Sweden. Let's take Sweden for an example, or the Netherlands, who have taken a much softer approach and have been, you know, treated like condemned in our media in the UK, and kind of treated as though they're doing something wild and out of whack, and that any minute it's going to be total mayhem and collapse in Sweden. And the truth is not that. They're doing just fine. Their figures basically line up with ours when you look at it with relative population size, and they haven't shut down their economy. So the truth is, we just don't know that. You know, you can take that argument of maybe 200,000 would have died, and it's like, well, that's not bearing out in the countries that are taking a softer approach.
Sure, but that's the problem, though, isn't it? I think that's where the dilemma comes, because if you're a politician and you've got to make a decision about letting something rip through for 200,000 people die, or you're told, actually, we need to shut it down and you may get away with 20,000, 30,000 deaths.
Yeah.
I mean, even just humanly, without being a politician, you're going to go, I think I've got to take the 30,000 and we'll take the risk of the rest because life is valuable. So, I mean, it's a really difficult one, isn't it? And it's easy now to, in one sense, look back and say, maybe, but actually being the person who makes that decision of going 200,000, 20,000 on the evidence that you got with the experts you have, who are experts in this field, and the guys who are making the decision are pandemic experts going, okay, this looks like this could travel in this direction. That's the risk, isn't it? You look at Slovenia kind of locked down harder than we did and have the fewest deaths in the whole of Europe per capita. So you could say, actually, they went even harder, quicker, as did New Zealand, and their death rates are much, much less. So in one sense, much more effective.
So did Greece
and
as well.
And that's the difficult.
I think Greece went in hard as well and have a relatively low death rate. I mean, I think it's the other caveat, by the way, to add to your other caveats, Josh, was that none of us are experts. So I think we're all kind of trading. Yeah, I think we've probably read more than we normally read on any medical story. So I think I think all of us, not just us three, but lots of people, I think, have much more knowledge than we'd ever normally have on a story. You know, I know people who listen to the news and press conferences who never would have taken any interest in anything political or medical that was sort of, you know, of sort of national stories. So I think we're all into it. But I think we're still trading to some degree on ignorance. I think it's really complicated because Sweden is a more dispersed, less family-based population, smaller population. And they did some lockdown. I think Netherlands did almost the same lockdown as us. It wasn't quite the Sweden model. The Prime Minister this morning of Sweden was saying how he didn't visit his mother because of lockdown measures, who died recently. And there are some other rules in Sweden, in the Netherlands. But yeah, I think it's really hard. The fact is, the sort of bell-shaped graph, or not so much bell-shaped, but anyway, the peaking graph going down, is pretty much repeated across every single country where there's been an outbreak. And the thing I don't really know is what would it have looked like with less lockdown or with no lockdown? And I honestly don't think any of the experts have a clue either. But it's a because I don't think, I mean, I know what you're saying, Mark, there are experts, and they are experts on the sort of the variables that you'd have to think about for a spread of a pandemic. I'm just not sure whether they're experts on something on this global scale, because I don't think there's ever been anything on this global scale in anybody's lifetime. Because I think all the other outbreaks they sort of petered out. They didn't quite go global in the same way that COVID has. But I still think it's a really excruciatingly painful political decision. My regret was that we didn't stay in the half lockdown for a bit longer, where the churches had been closed and lots of public stuff, and where we were doing social distancing, protecting the vulnerable, and a sort of general encouragement not to go to work if you didn't have to physically be there. I think, personally, I think we should have stayed on that bit longer. That kind of where we were on Mothering Sunday, just before the big lockdown on Monday, that was a sort of partial lockdown. And I just think maybe we should have stuck with that for about another 3 weeks and seen how did that start to affect the numbers. I think no lockdown would have been irresponsible. I just don't think that would have been credible. So I think having no suggestion, no rules, and even Sweden hasn't done that.
I think, again, the problem is, we can all agree that some measures were definitely needed, for sure. Yeah. It all comes down to cost-benefit, doesn't it? So, for example, in the US now, they've got unemployment of over 14% right now because of COVID, which is millions of people who have lost their incomes. And there's reports of global poverty and hunger that are scary, that are a direct result of the measures that we've taken, and that's affecting again millions of people, if not more. Now it becomes
domestic abuse, mental health issues, people not turning up for cancer appointments or heart attacks, all that stuff.
Cancer referrals are down 70-80% just in the UK. Now that is going to kill probably more people than COVID even has. So it becomes a very complicated question about cost benefit analysis and whether we're going to be able to turn around and say that was worth it. And again, like, none of us know, but my feeling is right now that the cost is outweighing the benefit. And it sounds really horrible to say that, because you say, but 30,000 people died, and it's like, that's awful. But then you weigh in the other factors of actually the average death age of people anyway, and those people, you might, let's put it this way, you might have only saved a bunch of people for another year, maybe for six, seven months. They're going to die of something.
And I think all of those are factors. I just wonder, though, whether it's, you know, for us sitting here in sunny Sussex, where it hasn't impacted, and where, as far as I'm aware, none of us have lost anyone as a result of COVID, you know, we'd feel very differently if, you know, my brother had died or your brother had died of COVID, and actually felt it more. And because I think I'm observing that, as you know, as I look around, so I think there's a sense of it's over now, we've got to get on with it. And you can tell people aren't quite keeping the lockdown rules anymore that is sure. kind of going. And partly I wonder is because actually it just doesn't feel like we're impacted at all. I wonder whether it would feel different if you're in London where you've kind of have felt the impact, you've heard the sirens going all nights, you know, in that initial stage, or whether you are much more closely connected to people. You know, we know of a church where, 10 members all died of COVID-19 up in the Midlands. Now, if that was true of our church, would we be talking in this? That's what I'm saying. I just wonder whether, because of it, the impact has felt less to us, praise God, and therefore does it, you know, therefore we raise this. Whereas if you feel it more, would we have a very yeah. different view on it?
You're probably right, but I think we've got to say, though, feelings don't really matter. I mean, we've got to look at the data in terms of actually a government decision, because you can make emotional arguments about saying, OK, what if it was my brother? And it would be terrible. But it would also be terrible if my brother died of anything. And that doesn't legitimize a lockdown, actually, when you take it just as data. And statistically, the number of young people, for example, that are dying of this, statistically is insignificant. It's almost irrelevant. So I think, you know, those emotional arguments, they work because you think about it and you go, do you know what, you're right. Like, we've been really blessed and it's great that no one we know has died. And we might feel differently if they had, but I don't think that changes the objective fact about measures and about how you actually cope with this as a nation.
Well, only in the sense of you become more aware of it. I think that's the
sure.
thing.
Yeah.
So therefore you have a greater understanding. But I think, conscious of time, I think it's worth thinking, okay, so
yeah.
all of that's true. With all those things we've been talking about and all those different views, how do we then relate to that as ordinary Christians? You know, how do we, you know, even if we are disagree with government or we think that their policies aren't quite right or they've overstepped it, you know, how do we therefore respond as Christians?
I want you to answer that.
To lead into that, just to say, you know, I do know someone who I knew reasonably well who died of COVID, who was my age, so that does have an emotional sort of impact. I don't think it changed my views on the fact that I think the lockdown was too hard, but it does change my views, I suppose, on the fact that we have to show compassion and sort of be quite measured and not dismissive about the arguments, because that's partly out of love for other people. You know, I had to write a card to this guy. He's in one of the committees I'm on in Affinity. And, you know, we had to write an official sort of letter and obituary. And also, you know, I had to write to his wife. You know, he's got a lot of kids, and of various age ranges, and, you know, his wife's left. So the sort of compassion part of it. So I think very dismissively saying, well, it wasn't that many lives. You know, he was in his 50s, so he was in the sort of borderline where you start to become statistically significant. And then it sort of obviously takes off in the 60s, 70s and 80s. So I think whatever we say has to be with a degree of sort of, not sort of compassion, actual compassion, and recognising the difficulties of weighing that as a politician, the difference between the sort of economic big picture and the individual or mass individual stories of death tied to a particular thing, you know, and the political impact of that, but also the sort of moral feeling about that. So I think one thing is compassion, but I could say lots more, but maybe you want to say some more, Mark, about how we respond.
Can I restate a question just
yes.
to get some clarity?
Yeah.
In principle, does there come a point where a Christian should rightly disobey government? Where is that line? How do you judge that? And if that line hasn't been crossed but you disagree with a government decision or policy, how do you act as a Christian?
I think the line is to do with whether you're personally being asked to do something which is against God's law and will for you. I don't think, for example, travelling at 20 miles an hour in Brighton is a sort of question on which I think, well, I don't think it saves any lives, so I'm going to go 50. I think it has to be sort of moral. If someone's asking me to do something that I think is illegal or against God's law, then I think that is the moment of conscience. Or if I think a policy is so immoral, that even though I might not be personally asked, I think the sort of degree of protest should be very intense. So even if I'm not personally aborting babies, I think I should be, my protest should be proportionately intense against it. And every opportunity, I'm not practicing what I preach here, by the way, but every opportunity to protest, you know, should be taken, and to use all possible means to protest, because I think it's a moral outrage. And so I reckon the COVID thing is somewhere in between those two. I don't think it's as trivial as a speed limit, but I don't think it's as weighty as abortion. Sorry, Mark, you go.
Yeah.
Well, no, I mean, I think there is. The only time I think disobey government in absolute being is when it goes against what God has commanded, and where I can see biblically there's a disagreement with that sense. So I don't then for submit to obey to its commands. You know, but if on speed limits, I'm called to submit to their authorities. Now, that's not to say that I obey that, but I'm still called to do so, even if I agree with it or disagree with it.
Yes.
And I think the COVID-19 is the same thing. I may not agree with it, but I'm called to submit. I think that's what Romans 13 says. You submit to the laws. And I think one of the ways we share testimony and evangelize is by showing to be good neighbors, by upholding that and modeling that and saying, well, actually, look, I might not agree with it, but this is where the rules, this is where the government of the day has, and I cannot see that it's going against what the Bible is saying, therefore I'm going to submit to it. Now,
can I ask a question on that?
Sure.
What if your disagreement with that policy, just going back to COVID, and I'm not saying this is the case for me, but what if your disagreement is on the level of, actually, I think this is causing more harm to more people, and therefore that is a moral issue that does go against what I think as a Christian is right. Do you understand? So it's not just a matter of policy, it's a matter of actually this is causing harm. So it's a little bit more blurred than just saying actually it's like a speed limit, and like Graham said, it's somewhere in between.
Yeah, I think so, but I think what I was trying to say was the degree of protest may go up, but I think that's different to actually disobeying. So I think if you disobey the lockdown rules as a matter of conscience, I can't see A, how it achieves anything of any value, or how it shows any respect for authority. So I don't think it has any useful purpose. I think though, if you feel, and I think it's quite legitimate to say, I think morally this is the wrong decision, because I think long term, the economic damage, the world poverty damage, the other deaths damage is far outweighing what we're achieving through this. So, you know, I know it's rather dull, but, you know, writing to MPs, emailing MPs, writing to Boris Johnson, and, you know, taking every opportunity to do that, engaging with other people, you know, even form an action group to protest. I think all those things are legitimate, wouldn't you say, Mark? Those are legitimate things to do within
absolutely.
The law.
Absolutely, and with respect and reverence. I think we're called to do that. I think that's what it means to be a good citizen. You know, we're in a democracy, and that is part of our responsibility. As you know, so when we talked about the elections last year, I think there is that responsibility to vote, because it's part of being in a democracy and living under a government, and that's what we're called to do, and that's how we do protests. But I think at the same time, I think we, as believers, are trusting in God's sovereignty and providence in this. So we trust that, okay, this we may not agree, but we trust that God is at work in this. And then we take up our responsibility as a church. How do we care for those who we're seeing? See, it's very well protesting and writing and think, but actually, if we genuinely believe there is going to be greater harm, then at the same time as a church, we've got to start working out how we care for those who are going to be most vulnerable at that point. And I think that's how it's the two arms at work there, because it's too easy to, if I'm honest, to write a letter to an MP. I can do that and kind of essentially appease my conscience. But if I'm genuinely concerned about the vulnerable, the costs, how am I actually starting to say, okay, what are we going to do as a church to meet those needs? Because we recognise there's going to be greater mental health. We recognise that there's going to be some economic, hardship for some. Hence why we've set for us a hardship fund, and people have been generous in providing to that in order that people are cared for. We recognise there's going to be mental health issues. What are we doing as a church to speak into that and to equip people and help people? Because I think, you know, this is part of it, isn't it? We can protest, but how do we then, okay, how do we lovingly then love neighbours well into this if we believe that?
Yeah, that's really helpful. Any final thoughts, Graham? We're kind of pushing time.
No, I think just speaking in a measured way with compassion, with love, with respect for authorities, even when we disagree with them. And I really underline what Mark said, really helpful kind of balance in terms of both protesting, but also trying to mitigate by any means that we can use. And I think in the meantime, just to state the obvious, we should obey the law. And I find that really difficult myself, but I think we should, out of respect for God as well as out of respect for those in authority.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Ordinary. If you enjoyed it, leave a review and a rating and recommend it to your friends to listen to. And also do get in touch with us. We'd love to hear from you about your thoughts on this week's podcast and also any topics that you'd love to hear us talk about in future episodes. So ordinary@cchh.org.uk is the email address. Catch you next time.